I next met with Dr. Chris Flowers, and to begin, he commented on an ASH plenary session presentation of a trial of upfront treatment of follicular lymphoma comparing chemotherapy with rituximab to obinutuzumab.
So this is a very provocative study and one that potentially has an impact on the standard of care for patients with follicular lymphoma. In this trial, they took a mixed group of patients with follicular lymphoma and patients with marginal zone lymphoma and allowed patients to receive chemotherapy of their choice by center for follicular lymphoma and by individual patient decision for patients with marginal zone lymphoma. And in all the major results that were presented at the plenary session were the results from the follicular lymphoma portion of this trial. In that portion, there were 1,202 patients in total that were randomized to rituximab plus chemotherapy or obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy with 601 patients in each group. This was a relatively younger patient population than the typical patient population with follicular lymphoma, but only slightly so, with a median age of 59 years in that patient population. When you look at the randomization of those two arms, there was a benefit for the group who received the so-called G chemo or obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy when you compare the progression-free survival for those two patient populations. And that benefit amounted to a hazard ratio of 0.66. So overall, I think this looks to be a reasonably favorable result. I think there still are some questions about what this means in terms of anti-CD20 antibody. The patients who got obinutuzumab got a dose of 1,000 milligrams at a flat dose, and patients with rituximab received the typical dose of 375 milligrams per meter squared. I don't know that we're going to ever answer this question about whether the dosing of anti-CD20 antibody or the efficacy of the anti-CD20 molecule really made the difference here, because we won't have head-to-head trials that compare presumably equipotent doses of anti-CD20 antibody, for instance, using rituximab at a flat dose of 1,000 milligrams. But given the results that we have, these are a provocative and meaningful improvement on rituximab plus chemotherapy, which has been the standard of care up to this point for newly diagnosed patients with follicular lymphoma that have more advanced stage disease.
What about toxicity?
When you look at the toxicity, there was more toxicity in the group that received obinutuzumab. By and large, that toxicity is infusional-related toxicity with greater infusion-related reactions for patients who received obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy. There also was an increase in the cytopenias that were observed in that arm, with more neutropenia, thrombocytopenia in the group that received obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy.
But I guess it looked like the patients who had to come off therapy because the toxicity was about the same.
Correct, yeah. The patients who came off therapy because of toxicity was only about 16%, so relatively limited numbers of patients who are coming off because of toxicity.
So I don't know what the reimbursement regulatory issues are right now in terms of considering this outside a trial setting. Maybe it's going to end up getting an indication, but at least right now, at this moment, is this what you would prefer to do with your upfront treatment of follicular lymphoma?
The landscape in follicular lymphoma is becoming increasingly complex, in part because of the number of newly approved agents in this setting. I think we've got a number of new oral agents that are being explored in follicular lymphoma, ibrutinib, lenalidomide, and potentially chemotherapy-free approaches to patients with follicular lymphoma, both in the frontline and in the relapse setting. I think if this gets FDA approved in this setting and the publication shows sustained benefits for this population, particularly if there ultimately is shown to be an overall survival benefit for patients who get obinutuzumab plus chemotherapy, that this is a regimen that will be considered as one of the new frontline standard of care approaches for these patients. As of yet, while this is an approved regimen, I would wait to see the ultimate publication from these results and see how sustained those benefits are in terms of overall survival benefits.
So it sounds like you're not jumping up and down ready to start to do this. What's your thinking?
I think that our chemotherapy still is, with maintenance based on the PRIMA results, still is a standard approach for patients with follicular lymphoma that has meaningful benefits. Obinutuzumab is approved in the relapse setting for patients with follicular lymphoma, and so it can be used in that setting as well. And there are a number of other agents that can be used in the relapse setting. I think when you think about particularly older patients with follicular lymphoma, you need to think about not just what will you give as the best first-line therapy, but what options are there for sequences of therapy over the long run. I think this is an approach that, with the 2 years of maintenance, can potentially provide progression-free survival benefits where people can receive this as their frontline therapy and go for a long time without subsequent therapy. But it really amounts to, what strategy do you want to take for a patient with follicular lymphoma? Do you want to use your best regimen up front and hope that they don't need therapy for a very prolonged period of time, or use a regimen that provides meaningful benefit knowing that you have a number of options later on?
What about Abstract 104 looking at the incorporation in a phase 2 trial of bevacizumab with R chemotherapy in a high intermediate risk diffuse large B-cell?
So bevacizumab is an agent, as you're very familiar with, that's been broadly applied in Hodgkin lymphoma, has activity in T-cell lymphoma, but there are a number of other malignancies that are CD30 positive where this can be applied. And in fact, if you look at the numbers of patients that are CD30 positive, there are many more diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients who are CD30 positive than there are Hodgkin and T-cell lymphoma patients probably put together. And so I think this was an approach to try and address that opportunity for patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, combining bevacizumab with chemotherapy in the upfront setting, particularly for patients with high-risk features, where we know that high-risk diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patients do not fare nearly as well with R-CHOP therapy as either the standard risk or the low-risk patient populations. And so in this combination, bevacizumab given at its typical dose of 1.8 milligrams per kilogram was combined both in looking at R-CHOP and then eventually with R-CHP, so dropping the vincristine from the chemotherapy regimen. When you look at this regimen, in particular the group of patients who got the RCHP regimen, this does appear to be a tolerable regimen with limited neurotoxicity. The most frequent adverse events were seen were alopecia and nausea and fatigue, which predominantly are likely due to the chemotherapy component of it. Peripheral neuropathy and constipation, which may be another form of neuropathy in some instances of patients, was seen in about half of patients. So this is something that you need to consider as an additional toxicity that may be a result of the bevacizumab. But by and large, this was a reasonably well-tolerated compound. When you look at the progression-free survival that was seen in this particular patient population, for those who had CD30 expression, that was about 79% versus 58% for those who were CD30 negative. So we do see responses in patients that are CD30 positive and CD30 negative, as has been seen in other trials of bevacizumab as a single agent. I think what becomes a little bit more confusing here is to what extent bevacizumab is adding to the approach in those who are CD30 negative. But these results are meaningful enough that I think that this is an opportunity for selected patients to move this regimen forward without vincristine added as part of the chemotherapy regimen. But this needs to be compared in prospective trials to R-CHOP.
So are phase 3 trials underway now to do this?
I know that phase 3 trials have been planned looking at the combination of bevacizumab plus R-CHP versus R-CHOP. And I think we will need to see way down the line where this fits into play. And particularly given some of the negative trials that we'll talk about probably a little bit for diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, I think we need a number of phase 3 trials moving forward to ultimately find an opportunity for improving outcomes, particularly for high-risk patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma.
So right now in your practice, how do you integrate CD30 testing into large cell lymphoma? And are you using bevacizumab, and in what situations?
Most commonly, we will look at CD30 testing in patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the relapse setting for those patients who are referred for transplant as a potential opportunity for using bevacizumab down the line if those patients relapse after transplant. CD30 is part of our normal algorithm for lymphomas in our setting for all patients. And so we do get CD30 testing in the upfront diffuse large B-cell setting, but not something we commonly utilize for making therapeutic decisions at this point.
Have you seen any useful clinical responses to vedotin large cell lymphoma?
So there are anecdotal responses to patients in the relapse setting, particularly patients who have failed autologous stem cell transplant, both on trial and in our own practice for patients who have been treated off trial.
So we were talking about obinutuzumab and follicular lymphoma, and there was another paper, the so-called Goya study, presented with obinutuzumab versus rituximab chemo in large cell lymphoma. Can you talk about that?
So this was one of the phase 3 trials that I alluded to in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma as being one of, unfortunately, several negative trials that we have seen trying to improve upon R-CHOP. So when you look at R-CHOP therapy, that has been an approach that has been the standard of care since several randomized controlled trials showed that the benefit of adding rituximab anti-CD20 antibody therapy to CHOP therapy had benefits over CHOP. Since that time, there have been a number of approaches that have tried to improve upon that. The two trials looked at the addition of bortezomib to R-CHOP therapy and showed no clear benefit for patients with the non-GCB subtype, and another trial that showed no benefit overall in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. There is an ongoing trial, or two ongoing trials that have been completed accrual, looking at lenalidomide plus R-CHOP versus R-CHOP that we're awaiting results on. And then this trial was a trial looking at the anti-CD20 antibody obinutuzumab with CHOP versus R-CHOP in a very similar fashion to what we discussed earlier for follicular lymphoma. When you look at the diffuse large B-cell lymphoma trial, however, there really was no clear advantage to adding obinutuzumab to CHOP compared to the R-CHOP therapy. And in this trial, they randomized more than 1,400 patients, 706 patients to the G-CHOP arm and 712 patients to the R-CHOP arm. These were trials that were relatively well-balanced and fairly typical of the average patient with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma having a median age of 62 years in this population, and focusing on patients with advanced stage disease, with more than 3/4 of those patients having advanced stage disease, stage 3-4 disease in the population. They also looked at the subsets of patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma that we commonly divide them into by cell of origin, with a little bit more than half of those patients falling into the GCB arm, as is typically seen with the ABC and GCB components generally dividing about equally in most large studies where that's been looked at. When you look at the outcomes of this trial, though, looking at 3-year progression-free survival, there really was no benefit to G-CHOP compared to R-CHOP, so no significant difference in 3-year progression-free survival for obinutuzumab CHOP versus rituximab CHOP. I think one of the other interesting things about this trial and about a number of the trials that I mentioned, particularly the trials that have looked at bortezomib plus R-CHOP, is that the R-CHOP control arm of all of those trials have tended to fare better than the historical arms of R-CHOP, either in the older German trials or the older French trials or the older trials in the U.S. that ultimately led to the demonstration of benefit of R-CHOP. Whether we're more highly selecting patients to go on to these randomized phase 3 trials because R-CHOP is available as a standard of care, or there's some other reason that the R-CHOP arm is faring better because of supportive care or other measures, I think it's a little bit unclear. But clearly the standard of care bar is much higher than we've been able to achieve with any of these new advances.
Interesting. So there are two papers presented on lenalidomide maintenance in large cell lymphoma, abstract 471 and 474. Can you comment on those studies?
So these are two very provocative approaches that I think are interesting to look at for patients, particularly elderly patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma and patients who are not eligible for transplantation. The first abstract presented by Catherine Tiblemont looked at elderly patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who received R-CHOP as their standard of care. And then patients were randomized then to go on and receive either lenalidomide maintenance versus observation. And with a median follow-up of about 40 months in the trial as a whole, the progression-free survival was not reached in the group that received lenalidomide maintenance. In this case, maintenance was given at 25 milligrams, given 21 out of 28 days. And the group that received observation had a progression-free survival of about 68 months. And so this is an approach that I think with additional data, additional follow-up on these patients and publications of this trial is something that should be considered for older patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, particularly since this patient population is one where when they relapse, autologous stem cell transplant may not be an option as a curative approach.
So again, is this something that motivates you to think about it outside a trial setting?
Not quite yet. I'd like to see the publication first, but once the publication is available, I think this is an approach that should be considered for elderly patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, particularly since autotransplant may not be an option for them in the future.
So ever since we first started to hear about bevacizumab, I've been wondering when any more antibody drug conjugates are going to come into the lymphoma field. None have been approved, but there was a paper at ASH looking at denituzumab mifidotin targeting CD19. What were your thoughts about that?
So that is an interesting agent that has been looked at in B-cell malignancies because CD19 is nearly ubiquitously expressed, kind of like CD20. I think it's also an interesting approach because the vast majority of people will lose CD20 as they relapse and have had multiple regimens with rituximab, either with chemotherapy or in some cases as maintenance therapy with follicular lymphoma and in other settings that you've seen.
So they lose it? You mean you test them, they're not CD20 positive?
Correct. So some of those patients will become CD20 negative. Now, we presume that there still is CD20 on some set of the population, and we commonly will still use rituximab with their chemotherapy, but there is a subset of patients who you cannot detect CD20 easily, either by flow cytometry most commonly. So this is an approach that has been looked at in patients with CD19 positive malignancies. It is now moving forward in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma as an approach used in combination with RICE therapy in the relapse setting. One of the concerns about anti-CD19 antibody drug conjugates is there may be overlapping toxicity with the toxicity that's seen in terms of ocular toxicity. In many of those trials, they need very careful ophthalmologic exams, and with serial uses of the agent, that ocular toxicity is something that can become more prominent. And so likely the best uses for these agents are using them in combination with therapy and for a brief duration of use. And so I think the use in combination with RICE therapy as a relapse setting where you're only using a few numbers of doses of the CD19 antibody drug conjugate is a useful one. Likewise, as we've already talked about, CD19 is the target for CAR T-cell therapy, and so I think one of the things that will come into question is between these competing approaches, whether CAR T-cell as an approach or antibody drug conjugates as an approach would be a preferred approach for that particular target.
So I think one of the most interesting papers that was presented at ASH, at least related to lymphoma, was Abstract 619, a phase 1b study of pembrolizumab, the anti-PD-1 antibody, in primary mediastinal large B-cell lymphoma with relapse refractory.
So as you've undoubtedly talked about a number of times, pembrolizumab and nivolumab have really moved into the marketplace of oncology and become a prominent agent across a number of different malignancies. And I think that really speaks to the role of immunotherapies across malignancies broadly and something that we've seen for the lymphomas in specific for a number of actually decades now since rituximab was first approved. So immunotherapy really is nothing new to lymphomas. The place where we've seen the greatest activity in pembrolizumab and nivolumab is in Hodgkin lymphoma. And it only stands to reason that primary mediastinal diffuse large B-cell lymphoma would be one of the other places to look since it holds such close histological connections and biological connections to Hodgkin lymphoma. So in this trial, this was the KEYNOTE-13 trial. They looked at patients with relapsed and refractory primary mediastinal diffuse large B-cell lymphoma where patients received pembrolizumab by 10 milligrams every 2 weeks. And then as we gained more experience with the use of pembrolizumab, it was changed to the more standard approach that we use now, giving 200 milligrams every 3 weeks. And what was seen in this setting in a relatively small number of patients, so 18 patients who were treated on trial, that the overall response rate was 41% in this population, although the majority of those patients achieved partial responses, that being 35% who had stable disease as their best response. I think this disease entity is one that, when we look at it in the relapse setting, is one that is fraught with a number of challenges. The vast majority of these patients are cured in the frontline setting, but as we're moving now away from radiation, we may start to see more of these patients relapsing. And looking at this agent as one that can have a role in primary mediastinal diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in the future.
Does it basically look similar in efficacy to what you see with HL?
Maybe not quite the level of efficacy that you see in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, but it is quite impressive for a relapsed and refractory patient population to see this.
I want to ask you also about Abstract 145. We've seen a number of papers in the last few years at ASH about the issue of rituximab maintenance, both in the transplant and non-transplant setting. And this is another data set looking at rituximab maintenance after autologous transplant. Can you comment on this?
So mantle cell lymphoma, when we look at this disease entity, we typically think of it in two separate patient populations, at least. The elderly patient population, where the approach to therapy typically is with less intensive therapy, followed by some period of observation. We now know from data from the German group that in the randomized setting of giving rituximab maintenance following BR for those patients, that there's no clear benefit to giving rituximab maintenance. When you look at the other population of mantle cell patients, there is a population who have more aggressive behaving disease or who are younger where we consider autologous stem cell transplantation. I think there are two particularly interesting things about this trial. One is the choice of induction regimen that was selected for this trial design. We know from a number of different trials, from the MD Anderson trials on R-hyper-CVAD and from the Nordic trials and from a number of other trials, that there is a benefit to giving cytarabine or ARAC for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. In this trial, they used the RDAP chemotherapy regimen as their frontline chemotherapy regimen for patients with mantle cell lymphoma. So there was really no planned anthracycline for the majority of patients. We now have data from a randomized trial that the combination of R-CHOP, R-DAP was better than R-CHOP as an induction regimen. This trial takes that one step further and attempts to drop the R-CHOP from the regimen. There are really two secrets to that. One is that the way RDAP was written into this trial is that patients were planned to have platinum as their form of, or cisplatin as their form of platinum therapy, but it allowed investigators or centers to choose either on a patient-by-patient basis or on a center basis whether or not to give that or to give either oxaliplatin or carboplatin. And there were a substantial fraction of patients who actually got carboplatin as their form of platinum therapy. So I think when looking at these results, that's something that needs to be bared in mind because there's substantially less toxicity seen in terms of nephrotoxicity than what you might expect for an RDAP chemotherapy regimen. The other thing that I think is important is that patients who were not able to achieve a CR or PR with their RDAP therapy, they did go on to RCHOP-14 before stem cell transplant. So it does leave the out of giving an anthracycline as a regimen. And so that's an important distinction to make about this upfront regimen. The other thing, though, that I think is the key point is the way that the trial was designed, is this was a trial that was more than 290 patients who were randomized to receive rituximab maintenance versus no maintenance. And when you look at the benefits of this trial, there was a benefit both in terms of progression-free survival and a benefit in terms of overall survival, with a four-year progression-free survival of 68% and a four-year overall survival of 78% in this population. So benefits in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival to giving rituximab maintenance after chemotherapy induction for patients with mantle cell lymphoma who got a transplant.
I mean, it's substantial. I mean, 50, 60% reduction.
No, these are impressive results. Again, we need to see the final publication before moving forward, but this is the kind of result that could change the standard of care for patients with mantle cell lymphoma.
Now, they say this is the first time this has been demonstrated, but wasn't there a previous trial that looked at R maintenance after transplant?
So there are other trials that have looked at R maintenance after transplant. The best of those is a little bit of a complex trial that looked at R maintenance as a way of eradicating minimal residual disease and followed patients with minimal residual disease continuing to give R maintenance to be able to eradicate minimal residual disease. This simplifies that approach and gives kind of a commonplace approach that doctors out in the community can use, that after an autologous stem cell transplant, there is a benefit to R maintenance, both in terms of progression-free survival and overall survival. And if these results are ultimately published, is the kind of approach that should be used to provide that benefit to patients who go through auto transplant.
So I want to ask you about Abstract 182 going in another direction, looking at bevacizumab and CD30 cutaneous T-cell lymphoma. What do they look at in this paper?
So we've talked about the role of CD30 expression and how CD30 expression affects the activity of bevacizumab. The first place where that was really explored was in cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, where we saw that patients, even with no CD30 expression on their cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, still had responses to bevacizumab in an older trial. This is a trial that looked at 130 patients that were randomized either to receive bevacizumab or to receive the practitioner's therapy of choice, where the two options for therapy in this particular trial, so to receive the practitioner's therapy of choice, where the two options were either bexarotene or receiving methotrexate in the study. When we look at the results comparing those two groups with a median follow-up of about 18 months, the response rates and the progression-free survival very strongly favored the group who got bevacizumab, with an overall response rate of 56% versus 13% in the group that received bevacizumab, and a median progression-free survival of nearly 17 months versus 3.5 months. So this is an approach that I think with these randomized data suggests that bevacizumab has a role and should be applied in patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma.
Do you see patients like that yourself?
I do. So patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma are ones that are very challenging to treat, particularly when patients have widespread or disseminated skin disease or patients who ultimately develop Sézary syndrome. These are patients for whom a number of therapies are needed because they very commonly progress through therapy. So mycosis fungoides patients, I'm excited to see this as another therapeutic option.
Have you seen patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma who had significant responses to bevacizumab?
This has been an approach that we've used relatively infrequently for patients, at least in the mycosis fungoides stage. I have treated patients with cutaneous T-cell lymphoma that ultimately had nodal involvement and had progression of the disease, where I have seen responses with bevacizumab there.
So I want to ask you about a couple of papers related to Hodgkin lymphoma. First, a couple of papers on checkpoint inhibitors. One, abstract 1105, phase 1-2 study of bevacizumab in combination with nivolumab in patients with Hodgkin lymphoma, kind of interesting novel approach.
This is a very interesting approach, and I think the combination of bevacizumab with immunotherapy is one that you'll see a theme across this year's American Society of Hematology meeting. This is a very nice abstract that was presented by Alex Herrera, where they looked at bevacizumab in combination with nivolumab in patients with relapsed and refractory Hodgkin lymphoma who had failed standard frontline therapies. In this setting, patients received the standard dose of bevacizumab given at 1.8 milligrams per kilogram, and then received escalating doses of nivolumab here given at 3 milligrams per kilogram on cycle 1, day 8 initially. And then the two were given on the same day with each subsequent cycle. When you look at this trial, the adverse events that were seen were reviewed in about 23 patients, and they were reasonably frequent, although the severity of the adverse events were predominantly grade 2 or less in about 65% of those patients. There were no grade 4 adverse events seen in the patients, and fatigue was the most common AE that was seen in the population. I think the response rates seen in here are at least encouraging. The overall response rate was 100% in the 6 patients that had completed the combination therapy. But at this point, there were relatively too few patients that have been seen and reviewed to really know kind of how that will play out over a larger number of patients.
Where do you see things heading for this combination, and how concerned are you about the toxicities? I mean, usually PD-1 alone is not much of a problem.
Right. So I think the combinations that you'll hear about, the combination of brentuximab plus nivolumab, is an intriguing one. From this, we see relatively limited toxicities. There's a combination of brentuximab and ipilimumab that you'll hear about in a little bit, and then the combination of all three, brentuximab, ipilimumab, and nivolumab, which are the ways that things are moving forward. I think much like what has been seen for melanoma, we need to start to think about kind of what is the best approach for patients who have aggressive behaving disease. There, it's more looked at in the upfront setting. Here, we're looking at the relapse setting. But the questions are similar, is should we use the best combination of agents to try and get the best response and the deepest response, or should we sequence agents in order to try and limit toxicity and prolong responses or prolong the duration of progression-free survival? Particularly with nivolumab and the other PD-1 inhibitors, the other thing that we've seen is that patients can progress, but as long as they're progressing slowly and still continuing to maintain their quality of life, that's another approach that is a viable, very viable approach for patients. So combination therapy versus sequencing therapy is another question that we're going to have to answer once we answer the safety and the efficacy of these agents.
So you mentioned this study looking at bevacizumab with ipilimumab and nivolumab, a combination we see a lot of use in melanoma, obviously. What about this triplet?
So in this trial, Catherine Diefenbach presented data from the combination of nivolumab and brentuximab in a phase 1 trial with dose escalation, giving nivolumab at 3 mg/kg in all cohorts, and then dose escalating the brentuximab, first given at 1.2 milligrams per kilogram, and then given at 1.8 milligrams per kilogram. In this phase 1 trial, what was seen is if you look at the safety of the regimen, that it was allowed to progress from that first cohort onto the second cohort. The toxicities that were seen were at least one dose-limiting toxicity consisting of pneumonitis and dyspnea, and that patient was one who had received a prior transplant, and perhaps that may have predisposed to some of those toxicities. The patient did make a full recovery after those toxicities, and no other DLTs were seen in this cohort. I think that at this point, many more patients are going to need to be treated, particularly in the phase 2 setting, before we can fully appreciate what the toxicities of this combination are. But these are at least meaningful enough to move forward on the basis of toxicity. What we also saw in terms of the efficacy, again, in small numbers of patients, only 8 patients who were evaluable for efficacy, that 100% of those patients responded with a 62% complete response rate. So this, again, looks like another promising combination that we will need to add into the armamentarium as we try to consider what combinations of therapy versus sequences of single-agent therapies are options.
Maybe we can go on and talk a little bit about CLL. There are a couple papers presented on something that sort of was surprising and sort of wasn't surprising, which is the issue of lenalidomide maintenance in CLL, abstract 229 and 230. Can you talk about these two papers?
This is something that, at least out in the community, has been used for patients with CLL, even though it has not been subjected to the same kind of phase 3 data that you'll hear about here. In the first trial, that was a trial that looked at identifying patients with CLL and randomized patients across 5 different countries to look at the effect of CLL maintenance with lenalidomide. When you look at the patient population that was examined, you know, this was a typical patient population with CLL with a median age of 64 years, so what you might expect for most older patients with CLL. 17P mutations occurred in about 11% of the population. So again, with perhaps a little bit more high-risk patients than what you might expect for the general population with CLL, but about on par with what you should see for this population. The toxicities associated with lenalidomide seen were pretty typical for what's been seen in other settings in CLL and in other diseases, with the majority of the toxicities really being cytopenias and gastrointestinal toxicities. There was a little bit of toxicity of the nervous system disorder, which is a little bit unclear as to what that really constitutes, whether that was neuropathy. That was seen in 30% of patients versus 14% of the patients with placebo. So I think that's something that needs to be teased out. And the dermatologic toxicity seen in this setting, hopefully the most of that was really just the typical rash you see with CLL, but occurring in 60% of patients, it's something that there really are a little bit more details needed to know whether this maintenance therapy was behaving in a different fashion than what you might see for lenalidomide in general. But when you look at the median progression-free survival, it was not reached in the group that received lenalidomide maintenance versus about 15 months for the group in observation. So this is clearly a benefit in terms of progression-free survival seen in this particular trial.
How about the other study, the so-called Continuum trial?
So the second phase 3 trial, the Continuum trial, is one that was presented by another group of investigators that performed a second randomization trial looking at lenalidomide in the second-line therapy who were randomized either to receive lenalidomide maintenance at 2.5 milligrams daily on a continuous basis versus placebo. I think the important thing to think about for those in the community who typically treat myeloma, this is a much, much lower dose than what we typically would give lenalidomide with. So you can't walk up to a CLL patient and give them the standard myeloma dose, particularly starting at a dose of 25 milligrams. You have to start low. In often cases in CLL, you need to stay low. And patients can even see responses with doses that low. The lenalidomide was then escalated up to 5 milligrams daily from cycle 2 further, and then to 10 milligrams daily after cycle 7 for those patients who were tolerating those lower doses of lenalidomide. This also showed benefits in terms of progression-free survival, and I think is an approach that we should think about for patients with CLL.
So bottom line, when you look at these two papers, have you used lenalidomide maintenance in CLL in any situation prior to this, and are you thinking about it now?
I think the terminology becomes a little bit fuzzy here in terms of what lenalidomide maintenance means in CLL, particularly in the relapse setting. Essentially, every single patient that you would think about starting lenalidomide on in the relapse setting for CLL is receiving maintenance because it's a therapy that you start and you plan to continue until disease progression. So that's not exactly the way these two trials were designed, where therapy was given and then lenalidomide was given after the therapy. But I think it's an approach, at least in the former setting that I described, that I have used for patients with lenalidomide. And it is one that I would consider for patients who receive responses, that you might think of this as a way of keeping them from going on to other therapies if you're able to maintain them on len with very limited toxicities.
So I want to ask you about abstract 637. Venetoclax is the most recently approved agent in CLL. And this is a paper looking at people receiving venetoclax after ibrutinib or alpelisib.
So I think this is a very important abstract to think about and an approach to consider moving forward. As you alluded to, venetoclax is now approved for patients with CLL who have 17p deletion, where it showed clear benefits that led to its approval. Venetoclax also has activity in other settings, both for patients with CLL without 17P and in other B-cell malignancies, particularly mantle cell lymphoma, where we've seen that it's active. And so I think that we need data from trials like this to be able to address those other situations where venetoclax may be a benefit to patients. In this study, patients who had received prior ibrutinib were enrolled into a trial looking at venetoclax as a therapy for patients that had failed either ibrutinib or idelalisib. And when you look at the benefits in this particular patient population, for those who had received ibrutinib as their prior therapy, 30 of the 43 patients, or 70% of those patients, responded to venetoclax. When you look at the patient population who had received prior idelalisib, 29 of 43 patients, or 67% of those patients, responded to venetoclax. We still do need to see a little bit more data on how long those benefits last in terms of how durable those responses are. But we're again talking about patient populations that oftentimes are multiply relapsed, particularly after they've failed effective agents like ibrutinib and idelalisib. And to now have another oral agent that we can apply in those settings for CLL is really a major advance.
Again, are these data impressive enough that you could visualize using venetoclax? You know, common situation would be after ibrutinib.
I think after patients fail ibrutinib, the other agents that are out there that are approved in that setting are idelalisib, which has toxicities that we're aware of in terms of the diarrhea and pneumonitis and other toxicities that are of concern. And venetoclax, particularly with these data, is another agent that docs should reach for as an option for that patient population who failed ibrutinib.
I'm kind of curious now that venetoclax is approved. I'm sure you have a lot more clinical experience with it. What have you seen now in the last 6 months and a year, particularly in terms of tumor lysis syndrome?
So I think it still is very important to be cautious about tumor lysis syndrome. We cannot become complacent with drugs that are oral agents just because they're oral to think that they're going to be less toxic. And I think for patients who receive venetoclax, particularly those who have a very high tumor burden or have a very high white blood cell count, venetoclax is still an agent where you need to be aggressive about oral and IV hydration, and including admitting patients to the hospital to start low and to gradually ramp up their dose of venetoclax. I have seen some tumor lysis syndrome in patients with CLL, particularly those with very high tumor burden, where if you don't pay attention to those details, that those patients could have gotten in trouble. And so you need to be aware of that. That's not the patient that you start on an oral therapy and tell them to come back and see you in a month.
So the final paper I want to ask you about is Abstract 231, presented by Dr. Zelenets, looking at the phase 3 study of idelalisib with BR and relapsed refractory CLL.
So when we look at idelalisib, that is an agent that has been approved either as a single agent in follicular lymphoma or approved in combination with rituximab for patients with CLL, this is an approach to try and look at whether that agent can also be combined with chemotherapy. There have been concerns about combining idelalisib, particularly with other novel agents, where we have seen some unexpected toxicity in some early phase clinical trials, in particular in the combination with lenalidomide. So this is a look at trying to combine it with chemotherapy and randomize patients to idela plus BR versus BR alone. In this trial, what they found is that all of the patients were able to get through their BR therapy, either alone or with idela, and then patients went on to idela monotherapy after that. When you look at the overall survival that was seen in this trial, the median overall survival for patients with idela plus BR was not reached versus 41 months for the BR. When you think about BR in patients with CLL, that overall survival is about on par with what you might expect for this population. And so this provides data that you could use this in combination as a superior regimen, at least in terms of overall survival for patients with relapsed and refractory CLL. I think, again, these are data that we need to see longer follow-up, particularly given some of the toxicities that we've seen with idela, either in other trials or with longer follow-up on with idela, in particular the PJP that has been a concern, and the toxicities such as pneumonitis and the gastrointestinal toxicities like inflammatory diarrhea. So we'll need to see kind of with longer follow-up on these trials, on this particular trial, whether those things might be issues for those patients. If they are not, this may be an option as opposed to BR.
PJP?
So the new name for pneumocystis carinii pneumonia.
All right.
Well, the infectious disease doctors keep us on our toes by changing the names.
Right now, how do you incorporate idelalisib in your practice, and where do you see things heading? That you mentioned the concerns about toxicity.
So I typically use idelalisib as an agent in relapsed and refractory follicular lymphoma as an option in the relapse setting for patients who want a standard of care oral therapy. And in CLL, it's an option that I consider for patients most commonly after they've had ibrutinib and either come off ibrutinib for toxicity reasons or failed ibrutinib. I think now with venetoclax falling into that space, particularly for the 17p population, I think it's something that you need to think about how you would sequence those two therapies, but something that I typically use in later lines of therapy for patients with CLL.
I mean, is there active interest in this agent in terms of, you know, current ongoing trials?
There is, and I think these data at least speak to that, how it would be used in combination. I think how it's going to be used in patients with follicular lymphoma will need additional data to be able to support that. There is the need for randomized controlled trials, though, to confirm the phase two results that led to the accelerated approval in follicular lymphoma.
So, I mean, just sort of offline, I mean, do you expect that there's going to be a lot of interest in this drug moving forward?
Well, the PI3 kinase inhibitors broadly, I think, is an approach that is useful. There are other PI3 kinase inhibitors that have ongoing trials. This drug is the first approved PI3 kinase inhibitor, and so it's an agent that if we can figure out how best to use it, I think does have benefit for patients. I've seen patients with CLL who have had good responses. I've seen patients with follicular lymphoma, and actually had a number of patients with follicular lymphoma who've had very durable responses on the original pivotal trial in follicular lymphoma. So I think it has benefits. I think we need to weigh those benefits with toxicity. And there are many other approaches like allogeneic stem cell transplantation, like CAR T-cell therapies that we've talked about, and other aggressive chemotherapy approaches where we know that there are significant toxicities associated with that approach, and we weigh the benefits of the approach versus the toxicity. I think that's an important thing that we'll need to do for idelalisib in terms of how we sequence it and where we place it.